Welcome to the podcast of Focus 580, featuring interviews with newsmakers and experts on international affairs and daily life, hosted by David Inge at WILL Radio, Urbana, Illinois. Please support this service by becoming a member and visit us on the web at will.uiuc.edu.
This is Focus 580. It's the second hour of our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frayne at the controls this morning. In this part of Focus, we will return to a topic that we have touched on now and again here on the program, particularly about this time of year over the last few years, and that is nanotechnology. It is this time of the year where now over the past several years, as I say, the folks here at the Center for Nanotechnology Research have had a conference. This is now, I believe, the third year where the conference – the fourth year this conference has taken place. In an effort, among other things, just to get some information out there about what nanotechnology is, some of the research work that has gone on here at the university, and some of the potential applications. And we have three guests with us in the studio to do that very thing, to try to talk a bit basically, again, for people who don't quite understand, and I have to put myself in that category of I'm not really quite sure yet. As many times I've talked about it, I still quite understand. But one day, even I will understand. We'll talk basically about what nanotechnology is and some of its applications and the way that people here at the university from different backgrounds and different disciplines are working together to develop that. And we have three guests with us. Lasanmi Adishina, he is the interim dean of the College of Engineering and also happens to be the director of the University of Illinois Center for Nanoscale Science and Technology. Irfan Ahmad is here. He is the associate director of the center. He's also directing a project that has been funded by the National Cancer Institute. That's a center to look at how nanotechnology might be applied to the treatment of cancer. And our third guest is Brad Schwartz. He's the regional dean of the College of Medicine here at University of Illinois. He is an MD physician. And pleased to have all of them here on the show. Now, as we talk, people who are listening should feel welcome to call in with questions. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Thank you all very much for being here.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. I think probably we should start, as we probably have done every time that we've had one of these conversations, and as by trying to talk a little bit about what nanotechnology is. The one thing I guess that people will understand, or maybe won't understand, is that we're talking about something that's small, that's really small. Engineering and science on a small scale, at least on the molecular scale. Can somebody start and give us just a real basic definition of nanotechnology?
Well, there can be a scientific definition where one nanometer is about a billionth of a meter. So that's the official description, but one can also characterize in terms of inches, billion, but the fundamental issue is that this is very, very small. And start looking at the atomic level. What new science can you gain? And what new technology can you translate that science into at those levels? Mm-hmm. Because when materials get to that level, they exhibit different properties from what we see on a macro scale, on a big scale, than what we see usually.
Yeah.
So our mission in this sort of technologies, what are the new science we can derive because of the impact of the length that we are dealing with? Mm-hmm. And how can we use that science in various applications? And as we've been discussing prior getting to the air, is that some of the applications that we see on measurement, fabrication, how you make things, and how you characterize them becomes very important in medicine. Critical issues when you start looking at how do cells adhere to each other? How do they stick together? Because sticking of cells affect how cancer goes. And is it possible to actually measure the force with which cells stick together? Those are even beyond nano. It's in the pico, which is even 1,000 times bigger, I mean smaller than nano. So those are critical things we have can start getting our hands on. I started looking at the science of how to make, how to measure, how to characterize it at that level. Those are new areas for us, and those are new areas for very many technologies that will come in the future.
And already now, and I suppose the only reason I know this is not very long ago, I was talking with a law professor about the issue of regulation of nanotechnology. There are a great many products that are on the market that are available that have used nanotechnology. Personal care products, medical products, sporting goods, a lot of different things that already are taking advantage of this technology.
Yeah. I'd just like to put this into perspective in terms of the scale level. When you talk about nanometer scale, our DNA is about 2.5 nanometer, and the red blood cell is about 2,500 nanometers. So if you're visualizing, it's a it's a scale dimension that we are talking about. So by the strictest definition, it's from 1 nanometer to 100 nanometer, which the National Nanotechnology Initiative defines it. Now, coming back to your comment about the number of products, there are about 250-some products out there in the market, ranging from the textile products, your trousers and your shirts, and then, of course, your cell phones and your computers and all. Use these. So, but the issue arises when we talk about nanoparticles and for advanced drug delivery and gene delivery systems. Mm-hmm. And that's where what we call the societal implications of nanotechnology come about.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me turn here. Now it seems natural to turn to Dr. Schwartz and have you talk a little bit about potential applications for nanotechnology in medicine and what things there you find particularly exciting and interesting?
Well, it seems that in today's world, the potential applications are limited only by people's imaginations. And the truth of the matter is the real applications to date have been few, but the potential is enormous. And so one can go from the really amazing, such as designing small measuring devices that can circulate in people's blood and give a constant stream of information for management of, for instance, diabetes. Mm-hmm. Diabetes is a very good example because in somebody whose blood sugar regulation is normal, they have molecular sensors in certain cells in the body that sense how much blood sugar there is and send a message to other cells in the body and tell those cells whether you need to make more insulin so that you could use some of the blood sugar or release more glucagon, which is another hormone, so that the body can release some of its stored sugar. And as you know, diabetes is a growing problem in our society, and the ideal regulation of it would mimic the physiologic regulation. And so the possibility is there that we could have small measuring devices that in real time would keep an eye on the blood sugar level and then even more amazingly send signals to other nanoparticles in the body that would then release signals for more insulin or more glucagon, et cetera. That's quite a ways off in the future. I think that it is a reasonable thing to shoot for. I don't think that it is so fantastic that it won't happen. And I think that the societal implications of that and the quality of healthcare would be huge. There are other things that are a little more immediate. So when we think about some of the prosthetic joints, artificial hips and things like that, in strict terms, the more advanced materials now are already benefiting from the advances in nanoscience because the design of the artificial hip itself as well as the design of the interface between the artificial hip and the bone that it has to stick to has been made much more functional because of the design of appropriate molecules that will serve the adhesive function. And to be clear about this, there is some overlap between nanotechnology and chemistry, which is also the design and synthesis of molecular scale substances. So there's a lot of potential.
a critical area there is bringing chemistry and engineering as an interface. How do you engineer certain things? Whereas previously they may have been happening randomly, but is it possible to engineer surfaces so that you can actually direct the growth or the formation of particular particles or particular cells?
An example of that, if I might, is in the area of nerve regeneration. So, for instance, the case of Chris Reeves is on everybody's mind. He sustained a spinal cord injury and was undergoing therapy in the hopes that some of his nerves would regenerate enough so that he would regain some function. And in our current world, about all we can do is try and optimize conditions for nerves to grow and perhaps apply growth factors in certain areas where we would like the nerves to grow. But that is still a very random event. It is certainly plausible to imagine that templates would be formed that could be implanted in the spinal cord that would direct the specific regeneration of nerves. It would tell the nerves where to grow, and those templates would be impregnated with specific growth factor molecules that would send the signal to the neurons and say, you're supposed to grow, and you're supposed to grow in this direction, and when you get there, this is what you're supposed to do.
Mm-hmm. So that's the where the engineering meets the biology world. I was interviewing a candidate yesterday, a faculty candidate, a mechanical engineer, who's almost turned himself to a biologist. He's very interested in growing scaffolds. It's a framework that almost like the structure on which can grow cells. So on the scaffold, he's trying to make some patterns to tell specific cells, stem cells, whether you go in this direction or in that direction and start differentiating whether it's going to be a cell in your muscle, a cell in the heart. But these are, say, mechanical engineer. I mean, these basic trainees in the mechanics.
Well, does that make you think about the possibility of growing replacement organs instead of now, say, if somebody has a problem with their heart, what we've got to do is we've got to find somebody who doesn't need theirs anymore and put that into the new person to get the heart, which causes all kind of problems because their body says, this is not mine, get it out of here. If you could somehow take cells from that individual and find some way to grow a new heart, it would, and then their body would say, well, I know this is mine, then you wouldn't have those kinds of problems with rejection. And of course, then you wouldn't have to wait around until there was a heart available because there are more people that need them than that have them. I mean, does this actually start you thinking that maybe not next week, but at some point you would be able to literally to grow a heart, a kidney, a lung, some important part to replace the parts that are going wrong?
Absolutely. But again, I think we have to be realistic about what this takes. And Adi pointed out that this is a multidisciplinary or an interdisciplinary undertaking, and that's essential. Mm-hmm. The development of organs as we're developing as a fetus is just fascinating. When you learn about the actual molecular and cellular things that happen, there are times that cells start off on different ends of the body and they migrate towards the middle and they meet. And it's incredible. It's astounding that any of us walks around approximating anything normal when you see what has to happen in development. So for us to be able to design a scaffold that would incorporate on it the appropriate growth factors in the appropriate place, becoming available at the appropriate time so that the cells can communicate with one another, is a huge undertaking. And it is going to first require that we understand how this happens in nature. We don't know that. So we've got to have biologists who continue to work on this. We've got to have biochemists who continue to understand the way the molecules are made available. And then these very people have got to be approaching these problems from the perspective of interacting with engineers who will be able to manipulate the system and create the appropriate scaffolding or template to mimic the natural guidance that these organs get when they develop. Just quickly to point out, a kidney, for instance, does not develop independently of everything else around it. It gets signals from all the tissues that are around it, telling it when to start developing certain sorts of cells and having the architecture approximate that of a kidney, and then have the specific cells attain their specialized function, et cetera. And so these scaffolds that we talk about that will direct organ development, and I think that that is possible, and again, as you say, it won't be next week, will require an enormous amount of sophisticated understanding that will require a very robust interaction between biologists, chemists, engineers.
Everybody.
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 Right.
Yes, everybody.
One thing I'd like to add here is, as Brad pointed out, there is this concept of what we call organ factory. So those are some of the things which are there in the horizon, but not to tomorrow, as you pointed out, I mean, in 10, 20 years from time. But there are some products like the artificial skin, which is already there. And so those are some of the developments based on nanoscale technology. One of the projects that was funded last year by the National Institute of Health was mimicking the nature to develop some of these products, and it's called biomimetics. And so the Center for Biomimetics, the design of nanoconductors, and one of the ideas is to actually help hernia and all the eye diseases. And it was funded last year as a center-level activity. The other center, which you had alluded to earlier, is the Cancer Center for Nanotechnology Excellence. And that's the center which Dr. Adishada directs, and I coordinate the activities. And it is physically located at the Washington University in St. Louis, at their medical school, with this campus being the nanotechnology, nanofabrication strength which brings about. And what this has done is to identify projects which would be translational in nature, in the sense that they would move to the clinical stage at a rapid form through this multidisciplinary interaction that we have been talking about. So those could not have been brought about unless some of these discussions or interactions would not have occurred under the center like this. And so those were possible because of these activities. And again, most of the center-level activities are, of course, based on disciplinary strengths and which each of the colleges brings to the table. But most of these activities or endeavors can only be achieved if they are done at a larger scale with multidisciplinary expertise, which is this campus strength, and then also leveraging other neighboring campuses to undertake that.
Let me reintroduce the guests, and also we have a caller who we'll bring into the conversation. Elisalme Adishida, he is the interim dean of the College of Engineering here at University of Illinois, also directs the Center for Nanoscale Science and Technology here. Irfan Ahmad is the associate director of the center, and he's also the project coordinator for this project he just mentioned, the Siteman Center of Cancer Nanotechnology. It's funded by the NCI, National Cancer Institute, to do works looking at how nanotech can be applied to treatment of cancer. And also Brad Schwartz is here. He's the regional dean of the College of Medicine, University of Illinois. Also do want to mention, by the way, there'll be a two-day nanotechnology workshop going on the campus tomorrow and Friday, and this is sponsored by the Center for Nanoscale Science and Technology. And the idea is to try to get information out there about just what's happening in this field on this campus. And I am assuming that anyone who is interested in attending is welcome to do that.
Yeah, we have people coming from Washington University Medical School, Roche, IIT in Chicago, UIS in Chicago. So it's gone beyond. We started this 4 years ago just to, as we said, this is multidisciplinary. Our campus is very big, so it's been very difficult getting people together. But with this being the platform, we've been able to bring a lot of different people together. But the conference is now evolving to be almost regional, that we have people from other schools who recognize the excellence we have here in nanotechnology, medicine, and other specialties coming to essentially see what we are doing. And we have a large contingent coming from Washu Medical School because of the partnership. And since we don't have a large practicing hospital here, we've been partnering with them through the College of Medicine to really have a strong translational component to what we do on this campus.
And if people are interested in finding out what's going on and they have internet access, probably the easiest thing to do is to go to the center website, www.cnst.uiuc.edu. So that's the Center for Nanoscale Science and Technology on the U of I campus.
Yes.
And there you can find all the details about the various kinds of programs and the sessions and who will be here and what they'll be talking about.
And what goes on campus.
That too. And, of course, if you're interested in, obviously there you can read about various kinds of research project that's going on here, nanotech projects going on here at the University of Illinois. You can see that there too.
This year, actually, this is the first time that we have added nanomedicine sessions. And our historical strengths have been in nanoelectronics, nanophotonics, nanomaterials, and also nanomanufacturing would also be discussed. And that's the confluence of these technologies at the nanoscale and the biotechnology are being brought about in these discussions and presentations. And, of course, we'll have speakers from the National Institute of Health and the National Cancer Institute and several other industries such as Intel and IBM.
Yeah, okay.
So nanotechnology itself is not completely new. Intel has been doing this for a while. So the interesting part for many of us is how do you translate what has been done over the last 4 years in the electronics domain to what you can do in the medical domain. Yeah. That's very exciting.
Well, why don't we talk with the caller that we have here, someone listening in Indiana. We'll get them right on line number 4. Hello.
Hello. My first question is I've had to amend now about 4 times listening to the talk, but I have 2 questions. They're sort of historical in nature. The first one deals with miniaturization, I guess. Illinois has long been regarded in the importance of its of the computers when they were started out and became some preeminent in some areas. And I wondering if historically if there's any sort of information one can learn about the process from tubes down to, say, surface mount technology, and of course now to nanotechnology on certain substrates. Whether or not there's any things that can be learned from that will help direct the blossoming of this nanotechnology. The other question deals with where is Illinois right now? At first, I thought this would be pretty black and white, but now since you got St. Louis involved and now you got Chicago, I presume that this movement of nanotechnology can be more regional rather than pinpointed to a specific university. And I thought, well, perhaps it's the nature of the beast that there's no one university can do all what's necessary to make this thing flow out. Just wondering if you could talk around those subjects somewhat. Thanks a lot.
Okay. Well,
the university here is extremely strong, as I said, broadly, whether it's in nanotechnology, because when you look at Badin, the inventor of the transistor, Professor Nick Holoniak Jr., the inventor of the LED, the light-emitting diode, C.T. Sa, who is not at this university anymore, the inventor of CMOS, which is the basis for your cell phone, computers, and everything. So the university has had a long, long history in nanotechnology. As I said, those have been restricted mainly to electronics and to photonics, things that bring out light, lasers, that's the lasers in your CD. But now, as I said, the focus and expansion of this area to medicine is a big focus on campus. But as the question asked, it's very difficult for one campus to cover everything. So it's just huge. Because the culture of engineers talking to biologists, talking to biochemists, it's a recent phenomenon. It's a recent phenomenon. So talking across the campus, talking to our colleagues outside of the campus at Cornell, WashU, everywhere, this is international, not just regional, but international. But every campus has, for us, we believe we have strong competence. And that's why all these other universities around this area are coming here to see what we do and how we can collaborate with them.
So I would add that as someone whose field benefits from these tremendous advances, is a good way to think about this is that this is a new way to make very important tools. And for us to bring all the benefits to society, all different aspects of society have an opportunity to find out how these nano advances will apply in their field and allow us to do things better. And mm-hmm. by its very nature, you end up involving people from many different universities and many different aspects of society. And that's probably the best way to look at it.
Mm. And there are some, although we've been talking mainly about organs, how do you engineer new organs? Those are far off in the future. But there are immediate areas in medicine. Sensors, there are programs we call Lab on a Chip. So instead of having what I call gallons of blood drawn out of people, you have only a speck on a particular chip, silicon chip, where you can do a lot of the same diagnosis, measurements, your blood sugar, lipid, everything, cholesterol, and be able to do spectrometry, be able to characterize this thing. And on the same chip, have wireless communication so that everything can just be telegraphed or telemetered to your doctor directly. So you can stay home and have just a drop of blood on a particular chip, and your doctor will know everything about your blood chemistry.
So you're talking about like what people do today to check their blood sugar.
Yes.
They poke their finger, you get a drop of blood, you put it on a little thing, and it tells you what your blood sugar is.
Yeah.
But now you're talking about something that you could do the same thing, that not only would it read your blood sugar, it'll read your whatever it
wants.
It'll read your cholesterol,
yeah.
It'll read your PSA, it'll read, you know, whatever it is, and then it would also report that then
back
to your doctor.
Home station, without you being present. So there are many, many technologies. The proposal we wrote last year is that you could actually stay in your room and interact with your doctor on the wall of your building. Many of these are derivations of nanotechnology. Be able to sit on your chair and weigh yourself on your chair acting as your weighing machine. So we call these technologies for assisted living, so that an old person doesn't have to live his or her. We don't want them to be very sedentary, but at least when you see your doctor, you can just be right in your living room and be sending a lot of information directly to your, and interacting with your doctor right on part of your wall that now becomes a video, a part of the architecture. So there are many far out things, but some of them are actually almost immediate, that all these sensors for measurement, sensors for looking at the blood, for urine, that you can just do an information telemeter to your doctor almost instantly.
Since you're the electrical engineer and maybe I might ask you, you just might want to comment further on what sort of applications. You talked about the fact that initially the kinds of things that you were looking at here were in that field.
Yes.
And now what you're doing is you're moving into some other things like medicine, for example. And I know a lot of people think that's very interesting.
Yeah.
What sort of applications, maybe you would talk specifically to devices like computers, can nanoscience bring? I mean, what will that enable you to do that you can't do now?
Well, when you look at I've been working in the field for almost 30 years. And at that time, my job was to look at how do you make things small so you can make smaller and smaller computers, silicon chips.
Mm.
Okay. We've not finished that journey yet. How do you keep making it? That's why now the computer that used to take a whole room is now in your iPod. Okay. When I was growing up in Berkeley, going to university, the computer that I used was completely maybe twice or three times this room. But the same power is now in my PDA. So you can just trace it directly to how one has been able to miniaturize silicon chips. So that is still ongoing. That probably will run out. We keep saying that the death of silicon is coming, but it never seems to come, just because there are very, very smart people who know how to overcome it. But over the next 30 to 40 years, we will actually move almost to the molecular level. Then what is next? People are looking at that presently. So in silicon, in electrical engineering, the traditional field, there's still a lot of latitude, a lot of ways to go. But in the electronics or the optical, the devices that does your telecommunication, space communication, your cell phone, lots of different things to be done. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of active training students, PhDs. Intel cannot have them fast enough. the laser people cannot have them fast enough.
Yeah.
Just lots of applications.
And I don't know. You can comment as Professor Arafat, Ahmad, whatever you want. I was just also thinking about the fact that now you're an agricultural engineer by your training.
Right, right.
What sort of applications are there to nanoscience to that?
From an agricultural engineering standpoint, there are roughly the number of applications which can be used as nanoparticles for pesticide research, because there's a lot of issue about the pesticide drift. And so if you have nanoparticles or you can do nano jet sprays, so you would spray at a point where it's needed. And so that way it will eliminate the excess use of pesticides. And similarly, you could use it like one of the or a couple of the projects that we have going on is looking at tracing grain from the farm to the fork. And there's more interest in it because of the genetically modified crops and non-genetically modified crop. So if you're able to tell where your grain came from and in what part of the field with your GPS coordinates and your genetic information, then it provides an added advantage to the companies and to the consumer to see what they are eating and what its ingredients are. The other is that to look at from a crop production standpoint is that when you're looking at fungus, the fungal damage, and to be able to genetically modify crops or to be able to engineer varieties which are resistant to fungus damage. Like soybean rust is a big issue and concern in the U.S. There have been occurrences in Brazil and Argentina. So one of the projects that we recently were funded for is to develop biosensors to actually detect the spores. And that can model be used for other applications like anthrax and others. But from an agricultural standpoint, those are the kind of things that we are looking at.
So if you look at fungus, some of them have typical or optimum size holes they like to penetrate. And if you know that hole, is it possible to engineer them to look for different sizes so that they don't penetrate roots to go and corrupt your plants, penetrate leaves and damage leaves, and essentially make agricultural products, less yield than what it is now. On campus, we've been working with people in NRES, just even look at how fungus attacks grass. Is it golf?
Tough grass.
What is it? Is it possible? What sort of configuration, the topology, the surface of a leaf? Because apparently when these cells grow, they have a height they can climb on. After that, they won't be able to climb it. And you can actually look at it in the lab. Use the same technique used for microelectronics. Engineer surfaces, put this fungus on it, and start seeing how it grows. And engineer the height. Okay, beyond this thing refuses to grow.
So we see that there is known knowledge that there's a chemical inducement in terms of these fungi growing. But the question is that we also see that there's potentially a mechanical component to it. And that's where we are coordinating with mechanical engineers and agriculture engineers coming in as an interface in terms of systems integration and working with the colleagues in College of Agriculture in trying to look at the mechanical properties which these cells exert on the cell walls. And can we measure those properties? And if we are able to measure those properties, can we then go about and help the plant pathologists in engineering varieties which are then resistant to some of the fungus which affects us and which destroys crops and so on and so forth and has large-term economic consequences?
Mm. One of the things I'm very much interested in having you talk a little bit about, particularly I guess I'm interested in what Dr. Schwartz would have to say, is the potential hazards of nanotech products. I think that there are questions in people's minds in part just because we're talking about something that's new, that has not existed before, that there might be problems associated with them, particularly related to the fact that the things we're talking about are really small and could be easily inhaled
these very small particles, or that they might react in the body in ways that we would be surprised about. We have, for example, I think now if I'm remembering right, just earlier this spring, there was the first recall ever of a nanotech product. And it was some kind of home cleaning product in Germany that was designed to make surfaces resist resist water. I think it was designed for people to use in their bathrooms, like, I don't know, to spray on the mirror so that it wouldn't fog up, something like that. And apparently some people were hospitalized because they had a very serious allergic reaction. They're not sure, I think, exactly what's going on. But something, you read a story like that and you begin to wonder, well, we're here now creating something that didn't exist before. We've done that before. We've made things and then later realized maybe that wasn't such a good idea. What do you think are the potential that some of these nanoparticles, these nanoproducts, would end up being problems for human health?
Well, I think that we have to be very cognizant of this possibility. In general terms, when you are designing molecules, particles rather than molecules, particles that are this small, they can gain access to parts of the human body that they usually don't. For instance, you can breathe them all the way into the bottom of your lung, mm-hmm. and that's very unusual. And so that hasn't had to be something that we worry about. These are things that can nestle into the pores in your skin, gain access to your circulation that way. These are, again, things that we haven't had to think of. Does that necessarily mean that it's going to be bad? No. But it means that we have to be cognizant of the fact that we are changing our environment. Another component of this is that, generally speaking, molecules are either soluble, which means they go into solution, much like you can think of putting sugar in a glass of water and stirring it, and it seems to disappear from view. The individual molecules of sugar interact with the molecules of water so that they do not change the nature of the water in any material way that would have biological impact. Whereas these molecules are things that might go into suspension, which means that it's difficult to describe, but it means that the molecule or the particle itself remains relatively unchanged, but it is as if it's a foreign surface within the body. But it's a very small foreign surface, and that foreign surface can serve to catalyze reactions among enzymes that were not expected, and those reactions may vary depending upon the part of the body that they go into. There are also things we don't understand. For instance, there's something referred to as the blood-brain barrier, which is a physical and functional barrier between the central nervous system and the blood. And it does a very good job of keeping things out of the central nervous system that shouldn't be there and keeping things in there that should be there and then allowing the right things to pass back and forth. We don't really understand how this amazing filter works, but we evolved to have it be very, very functional and very specific. And one of the things that you worry about with particles like this is that it is going to or some of these particles may impact the blood-brain barrier in unexpected ways. The question is, how do you test for that? In what instances do we know that certain nanoparticles are going to be things that we have to worry about? So this is going to open an area of, I guess you might call it, toxicology. I think that there are going to have to be people from the business world that get involved in this. There are going to be ethical considerations. There are going to be regulatory considerations, legal considerations, not to mention marketing and sales, et cetera. So I would say the ramifications are long.
I think the government has been has been in front of this, actually, looking at what I call societal impact and the consequences of nanotechnology. They've been funding quite a few outfits, the universities and the national labs, looking at the toxicology. I think there's a National Institute for Toxicology. They've been funding universities looking at what does nanoparticle do to a human body or to animal body to start with at first. So there is, because of the issues of GMO, genetically modified food that people have been rejecting, is to look at it on the nanotechnology side. What are the effects of nanotechnology on living systems? And how does that impact both in economics, health, law? So there's a whole lot of money going out. I think in some of the national nanotechnology initiative, 5% of the money that is given out is supposed to be devoted to this sort of studies. So that the government is way out in front in terms of making sure that whatever the benefits of nanotechnologies are quite known, and whatever the downsides are also should be well known.
You want to?
Sure. I want to amplify on something that Adi brought up, and you talked about the effects that the GMO introduction had. And I think we have to consider that even with very well-controlled, stringent tests for the effects of nanoparticles, et cetera, human nature has it that there is likely to be a group of people that are going to be very cautious about this. They're going to say these are particles that do not exist in nature, and we don't know all of the different downstream effects. And so I think that the care that the governmental agencies have had in investigating these things is well placed. But I also think that we have to recognize that there is going to be a segment of society that's going to be uncomfortable with this and is going to dictate caution. And we have to be open-minded about that.
So if I may add here is that there's a considerable emphasis on when you mentioned nanoparticles in being biodegradable or biocompatible. And so silicon nanoparticles are one which can be used inside the body. But then nanoparticles are also made up of other metals like cadmium and so on and so forth. So those are the ones you want to keep away from. So there is the toxicology component to it, and then there is this emphasis on the biodegradability of the particles or anything which goes, especially when you're talking about advanced drug delivery system and gene delivery systems. And so so when you talk about putting something into the body, there are, as Brad pointed out, the healthcare issues and the legal issues which will come about. Mm-hmm. And so... So in the research that was just getting started on this cancer project that we have is that there is an outreach component and an education component to it. The National Cancer Institute actually, as part of its strategic vision, has identified that by 2015, the death and suffering due to cancer should be eliminated or minimized. And so these projects, which they funded about 7 to 8 throughout the country, of which this campus is a sublocation to, is actually geared towards developing devices and therapies which would help out in identifying cancer and mitigating its damage and going about and delivering that, even including talking about the DNA repairs using nanotubes and the like.
Well, you know, we talked a little bit earlier about we were blue-skying a little bit. We were talking about the possibility of using nanoscience to grow new kidneys or new hearts. So it may indeed be that one day that would happen no time soon. What sort of applications are there, medical applications for nanotechnology that we have, either we actually have, or it's something that you would say in the relatively near future, this is something that nanoscience will allow us to do that we can't do now. Can somebody give a specific example?
I mean, like your implantable the blood glucose level. I mean, so there's a very active research going on in this campus in terms of that, and so that would be with the juvenile diabetes and all these the diabetes issues coming to the forefront. That's one which would make the major impact. And then, as I mentioned about the new the project which on cornea, and so for your eye diseases, I mean, those are the kind of things that where nanotechnology will have the direct bearing. Mm-hmm. And in the foreseeable future, actually.
Mm-hmm. And there are many, as I mentioned, sensors, things to be able to detect different functions in the body that now maybe they're not not for implantation, but that you have in your hand that you can use to measure different things that we do not now on a non-efficient basis and maybe highly expensive basis that would be very, very practical, very, very near in the future.
Yeah. And I think that there are some immediate uses in assisted living situations. So, for instance, it's well within reach now to have a set of sensors to indicate when individuals have taken their medication, to monitor the fluid intake. Obviously, the things that we think about are if an individual has fallen or hurt themselves, but the ability to monitor people in assisted living situations so that it doesn't take as much time by trained personnel so that those folks can be more effective and more efficient. That's well within reach, and there are faculty members on this campus that are involved in designing those sensors and designing and implementing the reporting systems that send all the information back to a central site within the assisted living center and put it into the patient record, et cetera.
There are about 72, as the projections indicate, 72 million Americans by 2030 would have reached old age or the golden age. And that is would potentially be stress on the healthcare cost. So nanotechnology is there actually to assist with the assisted living, as Brad, in terms of their extending their stay at home and rather being in a nursing home or with a healthcare provider. So that creates a bit of independence to them. And as mentioned earlier by Ardi, they're talking about macro-scale flexible electronic system which are embedded with sensors and being able to interact with your physician or with your loved ones. That actually raises their self-esteem. And also with bone and cartilage injury as you grow old, and also with your falls, and also because of your ulcers being generated because of your extended stay in the bed or in your chair. Those are some of the measures that can be monitored in a real-time setting and be communicated to the physician so that alternative measures could be taken accordingly.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious here. Now, I want to ask the doctor something. Now, this is really a side issue, but it comes to my mind when I think about some of the concerns we have about healthcare in America today, going to the issue of the fact that we spend more per capita than any other country, but we're not the healthiest country. Here we're talking about, and I'm sure that for a physician, the idea of having tools that will enable you to better monitor the health of patients and do better diagnosis would be a great thing. And I'm sure as a physician you would say, the more information I can get on the patient's condition, the better I can try to decide what I can do to help them out. At the same time, it seems that we're still going for increasing technological applications, things that, in my mind at least, all they can do is drive up the cost of healthcare. As a physician, how do you think about that? And particularly how you think about this issue of how it is we keep spending more, but we're not healthier?
That's a very good question, and it's a complicated topic because you can't address it with just one approach. First of all, I would say that our desire to find out more about how the body works and then be able to manipulate it is intrinsic to the human condition. We have always wanted to know what's over the next hill, what's under the next rock. We've always wanted to know why, and that's going to be irrepressible. So part of that is human nature. The other part of it, though, is a set of political decisions that have been made. And arguably the greatest advances in health promotion in the Western countries have been in issues and initiatives in public health. Now, when you look at measures of health across a society, remember that you are looking at an average. And so the larger the segment of society that is unable to gain access to health care or to optimally take advantage of the public health systems that are in place, the worse the average is going to be because they're going to pull the average down. And so as our society continues to treat medicine, I mean, to put it in the starkest terms, our society has made the decision that medicine will be a commercial enterprise. And as our society continues to do that, there will be a significant and growing fraction of our society that can't participate in healthcare. And that's going to always skew the averages. So the question is, as a society, as a matter of policy, how can we get more people to be in a position to take advantage of all the advances that have been made while recognizing that all of the economic benefits of developing new technologies are also things that help energize our society and help propel the economy. So it's a complicated issue.
Well, my apologies to the other two guys here for raising a question that was slightly off the focus. We're going to have to finish in any case. For people who are interested in this nanotechnology workshop that I'd mentioned or some of the research that's going on in this area here on the University of Illinois campus, I would suggest if you have internet access, go to the website of the Center for Nanoscale Science and Technology. You can find out about their nanotech workshop that's happening tomorrow and the next day, and also read about some of the other work that's being done here on the campus. We want to say thanks to our guests, Ilhasan Miadishida. He is the interim dean of the College of Engineering. Irfan Ahmad, he is the Associate Director of the U of I Center for Nanoscale Science and Technology. Actually, Dr. Adishi is the director of that. And also Brad Schwartz, he's the Regional Dean of the College of Medicine here at the University of Illinois. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.